Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Pavlik. It's nice to see you. Nice to have visitors here on tourist visas from the Republic of Texas. Welcome to the Stetter family, or at least the portion that's here. Good to see you all. This was supposed to be a split sermon. I was asked if I could maybe stretch it out a bit. So we'll see. We'll see. You know, one of the warped views held by many in the Christian and non-Christian world is the belief that the God of the Old Testament was harsh and vindictive, as opposed to Jesus, who's all about forgiveness and grace and to go along to get along. Here's an extreme example of that warped thinking. Now, you may find this could be a little offensive. The point is not to offend, but we have an author who's trying to be ultra cool, but he's expressing a viewpoint in his words that is fairly common. If you find this offensive, you're in good company. In Psalm 69, verse 9, David said, "The insults of those who insult you," talking to God, "fall on me." David took it personally when his God was insulted. So if you don't like what this author wrote, you're in good company. Here's what he wrote. Before Jesus arrived and his divine father chilled out, the Old Testament God was, ironically, kind of a hellraiser. He was not a nice guy. He really liked killing people. And he may have been actually insane if his willingness to randomly murder devout worshipers like Moses was any indication. Here are the 12 craziest, most awful things God did in the Old Testament back before that whacked out hippie Jesus softened him up. Okay. There is so much wrong with that philosophy. Not the least of which is that the God of the Old Testament, the Tetragrammaton, who spoke to Israel, to Moses, is the one who was born as Jesus centuries later. But that's a topic for another day. Here's the number one incident. Remember, the author said, here are 12 of the craziest, most awful things God did. Here's number one on his list of what he thinks shows how vindictive the God of the Old Testament was. In his words, he writes, "Sending bears to murder children for making fun of a bald dude." Sending bears to murder children for making fun of a bald dude. Well, on a surface level, that does sound kind of bad. He's, of course, referring to an incident that appears in 2 Kings chapter 2. We're going to turn there and read what got this particular writer so incensed. 2 Kings chapter 2, we'll read verses 22 through 24. We're breaking into a bit of a context, but we're starting in verse 22 to identify who's involved here. "So the water remains healed to this day, according to the word of Elisha, which he spoke. Then he went up from there to Bethel. And as he was going up the road, some youths came out from the city and mocked him and said to him, 'Go up, bald head! Go up, bald head!' So he turned around and looked at them, and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Eternal. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths." Two female bears in the New King James. I tend to like what the Old King James used. They used the term she-bears. Two she-bears. It's a little more colorful than just two female bears. Now, this writer epitomized a widely held view about the God of the Old Testament and of this event. But how are we to understand this? Does this really show an irrational, vindictive God who just lashes out? Does it show an irascible, thin-skinned prophet who, when somebody gets on his bad side, he just calls down the wrath of God on people and has them murdered? Is that how we're supposed to understand this incident? Another question, does this event of over 2,800 years ago even matter to us today? And more importantly, does this event hold any lessons for us today? The title of today's message is Understanding Elisha and the She-Bears. Understanding Elisha and the She-Bears. We're going to take a deep dive into this incident. And in order to do that, we're going to have to orient ourselves to three elements. First, we're going to need to know where, then we need to know who, and we need to know context. So we're going to start by looking at where, and after we know the where, we're going to look at the who, and after we've got that down, we're going to go into the context. So let's go to element number one, where. As you can see in verse 23, the where is on the road to Bethel. Bethel was a small town. It was about 12 miles north-northwest of Jerusalem. It was a fairly high elevation place, about 2,800 feet above sea level. It was even higher than Jerusalem. Jerusalem's elevation is about 2,490 feet, so it's definitely a fairly high place. Interesting history about Bethel. Altars were established near Bethel, first by Abram, going back that far. In Genesis 12 and 13, we won't turn there, but Genesis 12 and 13 are worth looking at. In his travels, especially going to Egypt and returning from Egypt, Abram built altars to the Eternal near what became Bethel. Also, later, an altar was built there by Jacob. If you have a nice little string in your Bible or some way of marking your place, I would suggest you do it here in 2 Kings chapter 2, because we're going to leave that, but we will be coming back again and again and again. So, if you will turn with me now to Genesis chapter 28, Mr. Johnson read a section of this last week, but I'm going to focus on another aspect of this set of passages for today's message. Genesis 28, beginning in verse 10. Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Eternal stood above it and said, I am the Eternal, God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. God continues on in the conversation with Jacob, but we're going to drop down now to verse 16. Then Jacob awoke from his dream, or from his sleep, and said, surely the Eternal is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Then Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put at his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city had been Luz previously. Now Bethel in Hebrew is two words, Bet and El. Bet meaning house, El, a shortened version of the word for God. So it becomes the house of God. And Jacob realized that Bethel was a place with awesome spiritual power. So he named it House of God or Bethel. Bethel also housed the Ark of the Covenant for a period of time during the time of the Judges. Let's take a look at that. Judges 20, verses 26 and 27. Judges 20, 26 and 27. We're still focusing on the where of Bethel for the incident of Elisha and the she-bears. Judges 20, verse 26 through 27. Now, the context of these verses is Israel is at war with Benjamin. So one tribe of the 12 tribes is almost wiped out in a war with the other tribes. Verse 26, then all the children of Israel, that is, all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant was there in those days. All right, so the Ark was there. Notice in verse 26, they came and went to the house of God. And if you have New King James Version, it's likely to have a marginal reference that says Bethel, because that's what the Hebrew says. As we saw before, the word Bethel is an anglicized version of Bethel, a Hebrew word. And strangely enough, the New King James and the King James are some of the few translations that in verse 26 call it House of God. Most other translations that you will consult will say they went up to Bethel. That's Bethel. The same Bethel that we're talking about in our situation. So Bethel was a town that seemingly had a good start, had all of these marvelous things occur there. Abram with an altar, Jacob with an altar, recognition that it is a sacred place, a place of spiritual power. Even the Ark of the Covenant was in Bethel for a time. But, sadly, Bethel was a town that went bad. Things went sour for Bethel. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12, beginning in verse 25. 1 Kings 12, beginning in verse 25. Despite its good start, things went south, figuratively speaking, for Bethel. This is the time period Solomon has died. His son, Rehoboam, has become the king. There's a dispute with the people and political advisors over what kind of rule will Rehoboam institute and carry out. And there was a revolt led by Jeroboam. We'll begin in verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, so that we're moving into the north, and he also went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David if these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn back to their lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem, too far. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you out from the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. Okay, calves. If you have calves, eventually they turn into cows, unless they're golden, in which case they stay calves. So, my bad. And at Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places, which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, not the 7th month as God had commanded, which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. So Elisha is on his way to Bethel, and Bethel is a town that started good but has gone bad. It's a town with a blasphemous shrine, a place of counterfeit worship, complete with idols, illegitimate priests, bogus feasts, and sacrifices to those idols. So now we know the where of the story of Elisha and the she-bears. All right, let's go back to 2 Kings 2, where the story of Elisha and the she-bears occurs. Let's go back and reread verse 23 of chapter 2. Then he went up from there to Bethel. We've already answered the question of where. Now we're moving on to the question of who. The second element that we need to understand if we're going to understand the event of Elisha and the she-bears. And as he was going up the road, some youths came from the city and mocked him and said to him, "Go up, bald head! Go up, bald head!" So he turned around and looked at them. So we'll stop there at verse 23. So who? New King James says youths. Other translations give it these types of descriptions. Little children in the King James Version. Young lads, the New American Standard Version and the Hebrew Names Version. Boys, New International Version. Young boys, the Lexham English Version. Small boys, Holman's Christian Bible, English Standard Version, and the New Revised Standard Version. And little boys, Darby. Little boys, little children. That's the way it gets presented. The interesting thing is those translations are correct literally, but can be misleading. Because the words in Hebrew that we find translated as youths in the New King James and little children in the King James actually consist of two words. It's not a single word, as the New King James would lead you to assume. So it's important to understand those two words because they provide us additional understanding of the who. Were these little children, were these 7, 8, 9-year-old little kids, innocent little kids just out on a lark doing a little prank? The first word that appears in Hebrew is the word katan, Q-A-T-A-N. That's how we would transliterate it into English, katan, Q-A-T-A-N. Among the literal meanings of the word, which we find in the Genesius Hebrew lexicon, it can include little or young, but there's more. It also can include of lesser or insignificant importance or authority. So it does not necessarily mean little, as in little children, little boys, young lads. There's a second word in verse 23 in the Hebrew, and we need to understand that. That word is na'ar. N-A apostrophe A-R. Na'ar. You got to roll your R's, and if you're Scottish, you can pull it off, laddies and lassies. That word is translated in the King James Version as children. Now, but the interesting thing is, how is that word in Hebrew used in other places? Because that gives us a broader understanding. Is it limited to little children, the little boys, the little 7 or 8-year-olds? Other uses of na'ar include Joseph at age 17. Ooh. Let's turn. Keep your place. I told you, we're going to be back and forth. Genesis 37 and verse 2. Genesis 37 and verse 2. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flocks with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of, and it goes on and on and on. The point we draw from here is the New King James says, this 17-year-old person was a lad. The Hebrew word is na'ar, the same word we're dealing with back in the incident of Elisha and the she-bears. 17 years old doesn't necessarily suggest that it's limited to just little tiny boys now, does it? Other places where it's used as David, used of David when he is designated by God to Samuel to be king of Israel. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 16 and see how it's used there. 1 Samuel 16, verse 11. Now, Samuel is reviewing the sons of Jesse, and he's looking at some and says, yeah, this one looks pretty good. God says, that's not him. God says, I'm looking at the heart. In verse 11, after he'd gone through this list, verse 11 reads, and Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? Then he said, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we'll not sit down till he comes here. The word youngest is our Hebrew word na'ar, the one we're dealing with back in the incident of Elisha and the she-bears. So, na'ar in this use does not mean smallest or littlest. It just means youngest of a group of sons. Now, another occurrence, and for me, all I have to do is flip the page to 1 Samuel chapter 17. That word, Hebrew word na'ar, is used of David when he fights Goliath. And you can almost understand why all of the little kiddie books, the little Bible books, try to depict David as, you know, a little 8 or 9 year old with his little slingshot. And it's not like that kind of sling. It was these kinds of slings. But David was not a little boy. David was a young man. And he was a brave young man. Verse 32 of 1 Samuel 17. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him, Goliath, the big giant. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're a youth. And a man, and he is a man of war from his youth. The word youth in verse 33, referring to David, is na'ar, our word that we're focusing on from the incident of Elisha and the she-bears. So we've seen two uses of na'ar, and it's not little kids. It's 17-year-old Joseph. It's a man, young man old enough to be designated as king and willing to go fight the most fearsome foe the nation of Israel at that time had ever experienced. There are some other references that include the use of the word na'ar that tell us something about this is not limited to little kids. We won't turn there for the sake of time. But Solomon is referred to as a na'ar at the beginning of his reign. You can jot down 1 Kings 3, 7. That's 1 Kings 3, 7. There was another individual known as Hadad the Edomite. He was an adversary to Solomon, who in his when Solomon was early in his reign. And this adversary escaped to Egypt, where he married Pharaoh's sister-in-law. He was a Na'ar. Doesn't sound like an 8-year-old kid who's, you know, fighting the king and has to run and go marry Pharaoh's sister-in-law. This is a young man. The interesting thing about this word Na'ar that we came across in the story of Elisha and the she-bears is it comes from a root word meaning an unmarried male who's not yet become the head of a household. And as we saw in the various usages of that word, it can include a young man. So we're not dealing just with little kids. Let's go back to our story, 2 Kings chapter 2. We're going to look now at verse 24. Back to our story of Elisha and the she-bears. So he, Elisha, turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Eternal. And two female bears, our she-bears, came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Or, if you've seen the movie, My Cousin Vinny, the Utes. In verse 24, the word we see, youths, is actually a third Hebrew word. A new word we're going to have to introduce you to. Other versions translate this as children, boys, and lads, because they seem to be picking up on the differing words we saw in verse 23. But the Hebrew word is yeled, Y-E-L-E-D. That's how we would transliterate it. Yeled, Y-E-L-E-D. Interesting usages of this very word. It's used twice to describe Rehoboam's younger advisors, contemporaries who had grown up with him. These people were in political power. Let's go take a look at that. We're going to go to 1 Kings 12. We'll begin reading in verse 6. 1 Kings 12, verse 6. This is at the point where Rehoboam is being approached by the populace saying, your father was kind of tough on us, and we would like you to sort of ease up on the taxation and the service that's required of us. Then King Rehoboam, in verse 6, consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived, and he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. In verse 8, the young men who stood before him and had grown up with him were yeled. The very word we were looking at back in verse 24 of our story of Elisha and the she-bears. We'll continue on through verse 10. And he said to them, what advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us? Then the young men, the yeled, who had grown up with him, spoke to him, saying, you should speak thus to those people. And we know the story goes on. You think my father was tough on you? I'm going to be 10 times worse. But the point that we were trying to draw here is these were yeleds. These people were old enough to be in political power, to be advisors of a king. Young men, yes. But little 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old boys? Putting together all that we've seen of the background of these words and what we've learned about the place, knowing that Bethel was a pagan shrine sanctioned by the royalty of the king of Israel, we learn that the group of males who confront Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 2. Far from being just little children are young adult men of the royal and perhaps priestly establishment at Bethel, but not yet at the top dog level of authority. We might say they're part of the deep state, but they were not little children. All right, now we've covered where. We've covered who. We're going to need now to move on to our third element, which is context. And we're going to have to get a broad context, because we know our key actor here in 2 Kings chapter 2 that we read about is Elisha. But Elisha is he's firmly linked to his predecessor, Elijah. Interesting, the word Elijah in Hebrew is Eliyahu. Elisha is Elisha. I thought about using that because at least they don't sound so much alike, but then I thought, nah, they're going to forget who Eliyahu is. It gets confusing. You can't tell the players without a program. So I'll try to speak distinctly, if possible, between Elijah and Elisha. But we have to get some context. To understand what Elisha did, we have to understand more about Elijah. And so what we're going to do is we're going to flip back into the book of 1 Kings. We're not going to read very much there, but I'm going to just kind of skim through and look at the useful headings for sections that appear in my Nelson version of New King James Bible. Let's go, and we'll start in chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17. So we're going to be skimming things. And if you actually look above 1 Kings 17, the heading just above that says Ahab reigns in Israel. So that lets us know we're talking Israel, the northern kingdom, not Judah, the southern kingdom, and Ahab is the king. And beginning in chapter 17, we see that because Ahab was bad, was evil in God's sight, the Eternal told Elijah to proclaim a drought, and he did. And that really, really upset the king. So Elijah had to flee, and he fled, and he was fed by ravens in the brook. Then, that was a miracle in itself. You know, God's actually doing something that's so unnatural to take care of Elijah in hiding. Then the next section is a miracle with Elijah and the widow. And this is the story of the oil that never ran out, the cooking oil. The next section, Elijah revives the widow's son. He was sick, he died, and Elijah, through God's power, brought him back to life. So we can see right off the bat, Elijah is a miracle-working prophet. He is a man of tremendous spiritual power. In chapter 18, Elijah sends a message to Ahab. It basically says it's going to rain again. But let's look at chapter 18 and verse 4, because we'll pick up something that's important for us to keep in mind. For so it was while Jezebel, who you know was the wife of Ahab, Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Eternal. Elijah's life was in jeopardy constantly. It was not a good thing to be a prophet of the Eternal God, the true God in the nation of Israel, with its pagan shrines, its false worship, its illegitimate priests. Being a prophet of the Eternal was very unpopular and put your life at risk. So from there, we see the next section, Elijah's confrontation on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal and Asherah. And 850 of those false prophets get massacred when their gods are unable to produce fire to consume a sacrifice. And Elisha has water poured all over his sacrifice. And the Eternal sends fire out of heaven that just consumes everything. And the people kind of, at least for momentarily, realized who the true God was. And these prophets of the false gods were massacred. And of course, Elijah has to flee for his life again. These were Jezebel's favorites. He was poking royalty in the eye, and his life was in jeopardy. So he had to run. Chapter 19, Elisha has to escape from Jezebel. He runs to Beersheba, which is in Judah, and then he has to run again, and he runs all the way to Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. That we would refer to as Mount Sinai, which, as Paul tells us, is in Arabia. And there, Elijah goes into a small cave, and he gets this opportunity to converse with God. And he actually sees the Eternal pass by. Unique opportunity for a human. And now we need to read, and let us go over to verse 16 of chapter 19. Because this is important. This is important for our story of Elisha, because this introduces us to Elisha. God is speaking to Elijah on the mountain of God, tells him what to do. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, at Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. So here, God is selecting Elisha. Elijah did not select Elisha. But God's telling and hinting to Elijah, you're getting near the end of your ministry, the end of the work that I've given you to do. You need to start training your successor, your understudy. And the next section is headed, Elisha follows Elijah. So now these two E's, Elijah and Elisha, are linked. They're close together. Now we'll skip ahead a bit, because there are stories dealing with Ahab and wars and things like that. But in chapter 21, the section is Naboth is murdered for his vineyard so that Ahab can steal his vineyard. And Elijah condemns Ahab for this transgression. In the section that is headed, the Lord condemns Ahab, and he uses Elijah to do it. We'll skip over the rest of 1 Kings, because it just deals with more wars and Ahab's death in battle. And his son, Ahaziah, reigns in Israel. All right, so we've done a deep dive. We've seen who Elijah was, and we've now seen how Elisha became linked with Elijah. Now we're going to 2 Kings chapter 1. We're going to read a little more additional background, but this background is going to provide some interesting details to help us connect various threads of what happens when we get to Elisha and the she-bears. 2 Kings 1 and verse 1. Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. Now Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and was injured. So he sent messengers and said to them, "Go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this injury." So we're now seeing an event. Keep going in verse 3. But the angel of the Eternal said to Elijah the Tishbite, "Arise, go up to meet the messengers of the king in Samaria and say to them, 'Is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Now therefore, thus says the Eternal, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you will surely die.' So Elijah departed." There's a couple of things to tease out of what we just read. Notice that there's a repetitive use of terminology associated with come down and go up. Those are opposites. And we're going to see that opposition of repetitive use of sort of the phraseology of come down and go up again and again as we keep reading for our background. Verse 5. And when the messengers returned to him, that would be to King Ahaziah, these are the ones who were sent to inquire about the god of Ekron, he said to them, "Why have you come back?" He must have realized, wait a minute, it takes a while to get to where I sent you to go. What are you doing back so soon? So they said to him, "A man came up," there's that go up use again, "to meet us and said to us, 'Go, return to the king who sent you and say to him, thus says the Eternal, is it because there's no God in Israel that you are sending to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? There shall you shall not come down," there's that come down, "from the bed to which you have gone up," again that opposition, come down, go up, "but you shall surely die." So he answered, and he said to them, "What kind of a man was it that came to you to meet you and told you these words?" So they answered him, "A hairy man wearing a leather belt around his waist." And he said, "Oh, it's Elijah the Tishbite." Take note, Elijah was a hairy man. Verse 9. Then the king sent to him, that's Elijah the Tishbite, a captain of 50 with his 50 men. So he went to him, and there he was sitting on the top of a hill, and he spoke to him, "Man of God, the king has said, come down." Notice again, come down. Elijah is saying the king is not going to come down from his bed. Come down. So Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, "If I am a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. More miracles. This is a man who was closely linked to his God and was able to work miracles. Verse 11. Then he sent to him another captain of 50 with his 50 men. And he answered and said to him, "Man of God, thus has the king said, come down quickly." So Elijah answered and said to them, "If I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Notice there's a twofold repetition going on here. Two sets of people, 50s, going to Elijah saying, "King says, come down." And Elijah says, "Fire will come down." Verse 13, and he again sent a third captain of 50 with his 50 men, and the third captain of 50 went up, here's a wiser man, and came and fell on his knees before Elijah and pleaded with him and said to him, "Man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Look, fire has come down from heaven and burnt up the first two captains of 50s and their 50s, but let my life now be precious in your sight." This was something that everybody knew about. And the angel of the Eternal said to Elijah, "Go down with him." Go down. "And do not be afraid of him." So he arose and went down with him and said to the king, went down with him to the king. Then he said to them, "Thus says the Eternal," and he kind of repeats his story, "You're not coming down from your bed, but you're going to die." In verse 17, so Ahaziah died according to the word of the Eternal, which Elijah had spoken. Because he had no son, Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. A little confusing there, because you have two kings with the very same name. One, Jehoram in Judah, one Jehoram in Israel. But we're focused on Israel. So now, we've gotten deep background on Elijah. And now, Elisha comes back into the picture in a big way. And now our context gets even more granular, more gritty, as we begin chapter 2. And as we go through chapter 2, we're going to take special note of the geographic references that occur, because those are significant. 2 Kings 2 and verse 1. And it came to pass, when the Eternal was about to take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Eternal lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. All right, we've already had a hint previously that Elijah was nearing the end of his ministry. And as we begin chapter 2, we see we're finally getting there. This is almost the end of his ministry, and it was about to take place. So where are we again? Geography matters in this story. They start off in Gilgal. Gilgal is in the Jordan Valley. It's about 2.5 miles from Jericho. Those were areas that were very significant for the conquest of the land of Canaan when Joshua led the children of Israel into the promised land centuries earlier. About 2.5 miles from Jericho. Now, we see that Elijah is being sent by God to Bethel, and Elisha is going with him. We're not told why God sent him to Bethel, but he did. Now, the thing is, that was not a short journey. The distance from Gilgal to Bethel is about 60 miles due west, and it was largely uphill. This was a major, major journey, because the ascent from Gilgal to Bethel required climbing about 1,950 feet in elevation. I mentioned Gilgal was in the Jordan Valley. That area is about 850 feet above sea level. Bethel is about 2,800 feet above sea level. So this was not an easy trip. This was uphill all the way. Now let's continue reading in verse 3. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Eternal will take away your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. Now we notice that the sons of the prophets came out from the city, which indicates that Elijah and Elisha did not enter Bethel. But after this twofold notice of, "Don't you realize you're about to have your master taken away from you?" they return back to almost where they started. Remember, they started in Gilgal, 60 miles west to Bethel. Now, after meeting the sons of the prophets, they're going back to Jericho, about 2.5 miles from where they started. That's sort of an odd situation. We don't really know precisely why, but that's what happened. Now, continuing in verse 5. Then the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said to him, "Do you not know that the Eternal will take away your master from over you today?" So he answered, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." It's basically a repetition of what had happened at Bethel. Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to the Jordan." But he says, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. Notice we get twofold messages from sons of the prophets of two different cities. They all knew that time for Elijah's ministry was over. I don't know how they knew, but they were sons of prophets. So We'll have to find that out some other time. It's not recorded for us. Now they're going on from Jericho to the River Jordan. The River Jordan's about 10 miles east of Jericho. So we saw they started off, moved west 60 miles, came back 60 miles going east, and now the next phase of the journey is to the River Jordan, 10 miles further east of Jericho. Verse 7, "And 50 men of the sons of prophets went and stood facing them at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan." So we are at the Jordan River. "Now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was, when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, 'Ask, what may I do for you before I'm taken away from you?' Elisha said, 'Please, let a double portion of your spirit be upon me.' So he said, 'You have asked a hard thing.'" Nevertheless, that's inserted. It's in italics, so it wasn't in the Hebrew, but it is an appropriate transitional phrase. "If you see me when I'm taken up from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so." So we've got a miraculous crossing of the Jordan River. Interestingly enough, this is also reversing the course of Joshua and the tribes of Israel crossing from the west across the Jordan River, where the Jordan also was dried up in Joshua chapters 3 through 6. Then we have in that last series, in addition to, here's another miracle that is being worked by Elijah, is the test of, will God double Elijah's spirit in Elisha? And the test is, "If you see me taken up." Now to verse 11. "Then it happened, as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it." He saw it. The test has been passed. "And he cried out, 'My father, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen.' So he saw him no more. And he took hold of his own clothes and tore them into pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water." Notice he's repeating what Elijah had done. "And said, 'Where is the Lord God of Elijah?' And when he had also struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. Now the sons of the prophets who were from Jericho saw him and said, 'The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha.' And they came to meet him and bowed down to the ground before him." Now, there's a lot going on in these verses. Elisha sees Elijah being taken up. He passes the test that Elijah spoke. This is going to determine whether you have a double portion of the spirit that God has placed on me. Now Elisha duplicates the miracle that Elijah had just performed using his mantle. And he reverses the prior path that he had taken with Elijah. The interesting point in verse 14. It's recorded here, "Where is the Lord God of Israel?" But you notice the word is in italics. So it's almost an odd phraseology. Why would Elisha take this mantle, whack the water, and say, "Where is the Lord God of Israel?" If you take out the word "is," which isn't there in the Hebrew, it's almost like a plea. "God, where? Where, God? Where do you want me to go?" I think that makes more sense. "Where, Lord God of Elijah? You tell me where you want me to go. And as we will see, Elisha does do what God wants him to do. And we've seen the prophets. Sons of the prophets have come out from Jericho. Elisha crosses from east to west. Now he's on the west bank of the Jordan River. And he's acknowledged by the sons of the prophets from Jericho that the Spirit of God that had been in Elijah is now in Elisha. And they honor him by bowing down before him. They acknowledge he is the eternal successor prophet to take the place of Elijah. Now we're up to verse 16 in chapter 2. Then they, the sons of the prophet, said to him, "Look, now there are 50 strong men with your servants. Please let them go up and search for your master, lest perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him and up and cast him upon some mountain or into some valley." And he said, "You shall not send anyone." But when they urged him till he was ashamed, he said, basically, "Oh, all right, send." Therefore, they sent 50 men, and they searched for 3 days, but did not find him. And when they came back to him, for he had stayed in Jericho, he said to them, "Did I not say to you, don't go up?" So if you've ever been tempted to tell your children, "Didn't I tell you so?" It's biblical. You can do it. It's okay. But be cautious. You got to be careful. Some interesting things are going on here. Notice again this transition of going up and coming down. Elijah went up. The spirit of Elijah is now on Elisha. And the sons of the prophets are saying, maybe God took him up and placed him down someplace else. Let's go look for him. Elisha knew better, but basically they just got on his nerves, and he said, "All right, if you insist, go take a look." And then when they come back, he tells you, "I told you so." So now, remember, we're in Jericho. Read verse 19. Then the men of the city being Jericho, said to Elisha, "Please notice that the situation of this city is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground barren." And he said, "Bring me a new bowl and put salt in it." So they brought it to him. Then he went out to the source of the water, cast in the salt there, and says, "Thus says the Eternal, I have healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness." Verse 22. So the water remains healed to this day, according to the word of Elisha, which he spoke. Now notice, in a very short period of time, this is a second miracle performed by Elisha. The first miracle he did, that's recorded for us, is he basically, in reverse, parted the waters of the Jordan using Elijah's mantle, just as Elijah had done. And now, for the city of Jericho, he heals the waters. And the interesting thing is, Elisha reversed a curse that had been placed on Jericho centuries earlier by Joshua. Keep your place. Go quickly to Joshua 6 and verse 26. Joshua 6, verse 26. This is after the city of Jericho has fallen, with the destruction of Jericho, which was miraculous in itself. And Joshua charged them at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Eternal who rises up and builds this city, Jericho. He shall lay its foundations with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up the gates." So we know Jericho was rebuilt, but there was a curse on Jericho. And interestingly enough, in his second miracle, after being honored by the sons of the prophets at Jericho, Elisha reverses the curse with a miracle to provide healing waters for Jericho. Now comes what we've been leading up to. All of this background gets us to the incident with Elisha and the she-bears. So now we're up to verse 23. So let's read that again. Pick it up again in verse 22. So the water remains healed to this day according to the word of Elisha which he spoke. That's the waters of Jericho. Then he went up from there to Bethel. Bethel. Remember? He and Elijah had started in Gilgal, 2.5 miles from Jericho, 60 miles to Bethel. They retraced their steps from Bethel back east to Jericho, 2.5 miles from Gilgal, crossed the Jordan, going eastbound. Elisha retraces crossing the Jordan, going westbound into Jericho, and now he's going to Bethel. Retracing in reverse exactly what he and Elijah had done. So he's on his way to Bethel. And as he was coming up the road, some young men, I know it says youths in the New King James, but as we've seen, these are the young adult males associated with the royal and priestly blasphemous shrine at Bethel, came out from the city and they mocked him. They met him on the road. Notice that Elisha does not go into the city, just as he and Elijah had not gone into the city of the Bethel on the earlier trip through Bethel. By going into this city, Elisha might have been suspected of honoring that pagan shrine. So it's very important. This occurs on the road outside of Bethel, not in Bethel. Notice the contrast, too, of how these young royal slash priestly deep state men associated with the blasphemous shrine at Bethel treat the prophet of God compared to how he was treated in Jericho just days earlier. Note the contrast. He was honored in Jericho. He was acknowledged as being the prophet of God and having the Spirit of God. He gets to Bethel, and what happens? These young men come out and they do not honor him. In fact, they insult him. They came out from the city and mocked him and said, "Go up, you bald head! Go up, you bald head!" Notice the twofold repetition of the insult. We've seen this in our history as we've reviewed. When things get repeated, it's not just there to occupy space. You know, like somebody who wrote a split sermon and has to stretch it into a full sermon. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's important. It's important because it gets repeated. And this insult is repeated. There are many things associated with this insult. Go up, bald head. Go up, you bald head. This is more than just a personal insult. Remember, we saw back in chapter 1 and verse 8 that Elijah was hairy. Apparently, Elisha was not. But this is not just simply a personal insult. These young men from the pagan shrine at Bethel are essentially saying, "You're no Elijah." Remember, contrast with how he was honored in Jericho just days earlier. "You're no Elijah, you bald head. Elijah was hairy." They were not just insulting Elijah, they were rejecting Elijah's legitimacy as a prophet of God, even though God had already demonstrated that Elisha was going to be his prophet, because God had selected him and identified him to Elijah on the mountain. God had worked miracles already through Elisha, the parting of the Jordan a second time, the healing of the waters of Jericho, but they, from this city of Bethel, reject God's prophet. They were denying God's chosen prophet and God's handiwork. The insult also includes the terminology, go up, go up. Remember, I pointed to you the tension in these two chapters between go up and come down. It occurs over and over and over. You will not come down. Go up, go up. And how did Elijah disappear? He went up. He went up in a whirlwind, or as we might say, he got sucked up by a tornado. And it was well known that at Bethel that Elijah would be taken away, because we had seen earlier when they were first, when the two prophets were outside of Bethel, sons of the prophets came out and told him, don't you know your master's about to be taken away? So this was not a huge surprise. For some way, this was known and recognized. But by telling Elisha, go up, bald head, go up, they're essentially saying, why don't you just get sucked up to into the sky like Elijah before him? Just disappear. This is a variation of what we would say today. Why don't you just drop dead? This was an insult, not only a personal insult to God's prophet, but to the office of the prophet. Now let's go to verse 24. So he turned around and looked at them, and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Eternal, and two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. The word cursed, it's interesting. Here, in verse 24, the New King James says, pronounced a curse. The King James says, they cursed. He cursed them. Now, this word curse is from a Hebrew word, kalal. We would transliterate that as Q-A-L-A-L. Kalal. And it can mean curse, but it has broader meanings as well. So it does not absolutely necessarily mean that it's a curse. The Genesius Hebrew lexicon includes additional meanings for this Hebrew word, kalal, means to be diminished, to be despised, to be of little account. Notice that Elisha does not ask God to injure or kill the young men. He just pronounces a curse in the name of the Eternal. He's essentially saying, God, you take care of this situation. You know, that's an important thing for us to take note of. That's an echo of Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 35. That's Deuteronomy 32:35. Which is quoted in Romans 12, verse 19. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Eternal. It was God who chose to send the bears to attack those religious neophytes of a false pagan religion. It wasn't Elisha. Notice that the young men expressed their insult twice. Go up, you bald head. Go up, you bald head. Once again, by doubling it, it's telling us this is something important. And notice that God responded by sending two she-bears. Because apparently one she-bear was not enough. But a pair of she-bears, now you got trouble. 42 of them. Back in chapter 1, we saw when Elijah was being summoned by King Ahab, who probably would have killed him had he come initially, we also doubled up on the captains with the 50s and their 50s. Come down, twice. You get to Elisha and the she-bears, go up, twice. Two bears. That's interesting. Must be important. So dual insults to the prophet of the prophets Elijah and Elisha bring about dual retribution to God. And earlier we saw that Elisha's blessing reversed the curse that was on Jericho. It seems with the power to bless also comes the power to curse, at least with God's prophets. And the curse could well have been on that blasphemous shrine at Bethel and their supporters, and it seems that that curse remained in place until many years later when King Josiah of Judah totally destroyed the pagan shrine at Bethel in 2 Kings chapter 23. The power to bless, the power to curse. Now let's tie up all of these ends. I know there have been many, many threads we've discussed and put together. We've seen that Elisha and the she-bears is an event that's seriously misunderstood by most of Christianity and the world. It's not a situation of a vindictive, irrational God murdering innocent little children for the petty act of making fun of a bald man. It is not a situation of a thin-skinned, hot-tempered prophet asking God to murder little children because he felt disrespected or insulted. It is a situation of an event occurring on a road outside of Bethel, a town with a blasphemous shrine, a place of counterfeit worship, complete with idols, illegitimate priests, bogus feasts, sacrifices to idols, all designed to seduce the populace of Israel from returning to Jerusalem for the feasts of the Eternal as God had directed. We're not dealing with a group of little children, little 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old boys, just boys being boys. We are dealing with young adult males, likely of the royal and perhaps priestly establishment at that pagan shrine at Bethel. These young men came out of the city denying that Elisha was the successor to Elijah as prophet, even though God had personally demonstrated that Elisha was his prophet. God selected him and pointed him out to Elisha on the mountain. God had worked miracles with Elisha, demonstrating that the power of God was there. These young men challenged the legitimacy and authority of God's prophet. "You're no Elijah. Why don't you just get sucked up off the earth and drop dead like he did?" These young men also, by saying, "Go up, go up." Go up is a terminology that's often used of a pilgrim journey to a place of worship. So in addition to basically telling Elisha, "Why don't you just get sucked up in a whirlwind and a tornado and just get on out of here like Elijah before you?" They may have well been taunting him to go up into their city and worship at their pagan shrine. And he was not about to do that. So we see that this event is seriously misunderstood. And the misunderstanding of much of Christianity and of the world blasphemes our God. They use it falsely to picture our God as vindictive, as harsh, as heartless, as tearing up little children for just being, you know, boys being boys. That is not the case at all. It is a God who does respect the office of prophet that he has called. Now, okay, we understand that this event gets misrepresented and it blasphemes our God. So yes, it is important. It is important to us today, 2,800 years or more later. It is important. But it's also important for us for more reasons than that. Certainly we need to know our God and to know the righteousness and justice of our God. But we can also learn from this event of Elisha and the she-bears that God stands behind those whom he calls to do his work. And he's able to take care of threats to his servants in his own way. Now for us today, we may not think we've been called to do something as wonderful as be a prophet like Elisha and perform miracles. But I don't think we should think that way. We actually have been called by God to perform a miracle. And obviously, Elisha didn't do those miracles on his own. He did them with the power of God. The miracle we are called to do today is to change from selfish, self-centered, short-sighted human creatures that just focus on the day-to-day life of the here and now on the earth. We are to change to the very mind of Jesus Christ, to the very mind of God, to the very character of God, and to have an eternal perspective looking forward to a life beyond the here and now. Folks, that takes a miracle, and it takes the power of God. And we've been called and given that role as well. From the incident of the Elisha and the sheep-bearers, we who've been called to fulfill our individual roles in God's plan can take comfort in knowing that a loving God has our backs.